Trick a diesel. Trick a diesel.
Welcome into Triple OT. Alongside Evan Riggs and Mike Makey, I am Scott Chasen. Guys, I always intro it somehow. I'll just kick it to you. Mike, come up with something clever off the top of your head.
Yeah. Well, I'm watching the Brock Osweiler show today, and I don't know if you guys saw it, but he just nailed someone on the sideline, like in the first half, with the worst out of bounds throw of all time. So it's pretty great to watch Brock struggle.
Brock, good old Brock, the poor man's Joe Flacco, as I like to call him.
Both do you lead. Actually call him that?
No, I do now. I just came up with it.
I just like when he got traded, and like the trade was they had to include picks with him to trade him for nothing, and it was like that's how bad his contract was.
Yeah, it's got to be kind of awkward, like for those players that come back a second time, like hey, sorry, I'll try to be better this time on Denver.
Yeah, we don't want to pay you $17 million. We'll pay you like $1 million, and you can be our backup.
Yeah, we'll give you a 500 pack of freeze pops.
People forget that Brock Osweiler is really tall. That's why he sticks around the league for so long. People forget that. No one ever talks about that.
Underrated quality. It's can't true. Coach it.
It's true. No one ever talks about what a prototypical NFL quarterback that guy is.
Yeah, that and Ryan Fitzpatrick going to Harvard. No one ever talks about those.
And Chris Hogan played lacrosse. It's crazy.
What?
Yeah, right? Isn't that weird?
All right. I think this is enough about football, though we're certainly going to get to some nonsense today. Let's start off this podcast kind of the same way that we've done for a long time. I think we're on episode 60 now, or maybe Ooh. Getting close to that. I don't know. Let's start with the things we noticed. So, Evan, I'll kick it to you because you are probably the most passionate about the thing you noticed, and I can't imagine where this is going to end up. So, why lead us off?
I'm not as passionate as I would be if we were podding about a week ago at this time instead of our morning podcast last week. The NBA apparently doesn't – it's turning into soccer where
– Oh, here he comes. He's on my side.
when these guys get elbowed in the face, you just got to put on a good act, and it's a flagrant one on the other guy no matter what. Obviously, you have the ridiculous Carmelo Anthony, jumping in the Nurkic. Typical old man YMCA move, as I think I called it in our group message, trying not to get his shot blocked. And then the very next game, you have – Russell Westbrook getting called for a flagrant foul on his own jump shot, which the NBA actually rescinded the next. They didn't rescind the Carmelo flagrant, amazingly. I thought for sure they would. Well, and then you also had Steph Curry get called for a flagrant on his own layup. He hit Tally Johnson in the face on his own layup.
I will say this. Let me jump in real quick. I think the Steph Curry one, I know we went back and forth about the Melo thing. I think the Steph Curry one was the most egregious of them just because – like, that's the clear-out move with the offhand is something that guys do all the time. And he, like, swung his hand back and decked the dude in the face. So I actually thought that was a flagrant.
Yeah, but to change it from, like, an and-one to, like, kicking the guy out of the game is just, like, it makes you look like you have absolutely no control over what's going on.
No, I'm talking about the Steph one.
Oh, okay, I got you. Yeah, I think the Mel one was a little bit more egregious. I thought they were both kind of soft, but, I mean, that's to be expected.
Yeah, it's just so incredibly frustrating. I don't think you should be like it on a play where you get a foul called for you, on the court in real time, which I think all three of those plays, if I'm not mistaken, at least the two Thunder ones are both fouls. I think Curry probably got a foul call on that play, but I'd have to go back and watch it again. To have those reversed to flagrants is just it's just insane. I think when you see the NBA judging on like how long guys stay on the ground, like to go review things. I feel like that kind of impacts when they go review things. I just feel like they have a problem right now with the flagrant fouls.
I just think I've always thought that if you have to review something, it probably doesn't warrant an ejection. Like if you see something and it really, is going to call for the guy to get out of there, then it's something that you probably should be able to tell right away.
We have kind of two ways we could approach this conversation. Do we want to talk about the Carmelo flagrant real quick? Because we're going to talk about the Thunder a lot today. So I think it would actually fit if we do want to talk about it just briefly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Evan, what do you think?
well, we kind of know where Evan lines up on this based off some words he had on Twitter.
Oh, yeah. Yes, Civil War.
I did say this. I definitely don't think he should have been ejected. I understand why he was ejected, as I suspect Evan understands where the call came from, whether or not anyone in the world agrees with it except the NBA, because I don't think that was a flagrant two. And I said that. I would have called it a flagrant one because, as Evan mentioned, he is going out of his way to – you called it a rec move, but it's how you draw contact or how you eliminate a shot blocker. You jump into his body. In this instance, he put an elbow into a dude's face. So I totally would get the idea of a flagrant one. And I'm sure if it happened to a Suns player, I would be kind of pissed off and not, you know, agreeing with it at all.
You know, Scott, you remember when the Suns lost on the goaltending in Portland like 3 years ago? This is like my version of that.
I still haven't forgotten about that picture. I go back and forth with a friend. But anyway, so I could understand the case. I understood why they called it a flagrant two. I didn't think it was a flagrant two. I thought it was a flagrant one. You said you could get it was an offensive foul. Mike, where did you line up on this? Did you think it was a flagrant one in an offensive foul or just straight up nothing?
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting whenever I have to defend Melo because I'm on record just very much with one stance on Melo, but that I'm sure our loyal listeners always know. But no, I didn't think he should have been ejected for that. I've always been kind of in the more play on camp for most things. I could totally see it being an offensive foul. Yeah, I think the guy did elbow him in the face, but it's not one of those ones where he was like so malicious or something that, you know, is a guy just trying to cause injury to someone else. When you're going to the basket, it's really easy to slow it down and look at it and really pick out like the finer details of the contact, but it's so fast when they're playing. I don't think that Melo is, you know, a guy that has some record of, you know, being a super cheap guy. So no, I think you got to kind of understand that it's not necessarily the type of player who would do that on purpose and just like take a deep breath. You don't have to take an ejection. You don't have to, you know, find something that's not necessarily there. And I think that they kicked him out prematurely.
What would you have called? Flagrant one or offensive foul?
I would have just called an offensive foul. I wouldn't have done a flagrant one.
See, like I probably, you know, if I'm a ref, I probably don't call anything in that situation either way. But I can see how it's an offensive foul, like you said, Scott. And I could even see, like, if you really want to call the flagrant one, like, I don't agree with it, but at least I can, like, you know, I can kind of at least see where you're coming from, you know, see the logic in that scenario.
He elbowed him in the head.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, he threw his head into his elbow.
But again, like, if Nurkic doesn't act like he got shot in the head with a sniper instead of elbowed in the head, then I don't think the penalty is probably that severe for Carmelo.
I don't disagree with that. And then, so we had another instance today. We're recording this Sunday night. That actually just happened pretty recently in the Boston-Toronto game, which was what should have been, I think, Jason Tatum securing a rebound to basically ice the game. They're up by one, about 15 seconds left, maybe a little less than that. And it's the thing where, I know you can't see me, I'm kind of miming it, but where you kind of, it's like a rip through move. You clear space with your elbows, you know, you bring the ball across your body with your elbows. And he caught, I think, Fred VanVleet in the face, and it was an offensive foul. I don't believe it was a flagrant foul. And that's maybe a little more understandable because it was a clutch time situation. And in a 1-point game, to call a flagrant foul with 10 seconds left would probably require someone being shot. But that was another example of, to Evan, to your point, one, inconsistency in the rule, and just two, of the NBA kind of has to figure out how it wants to do these things, because right now it seems like it's very situational, and I think that's the biggest problem.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, you mentioned they don't want to call a flagrant in clutch time. You know, the impact may seem more because of when it is, but, you know, anytime you call that, I mean, that's points for the other team. I mean, that's just huge momentum swings in some of those situations on plays to me that are questionable at best.
Yeah, no, I agree. I've kind of been in the thinking that a foul in the first 2 minutes isn't always the same as a foul in the last 2 minutes. But if it's something like a flagrant, then you got to call that when you see it.
I don't have a problem with things actually being officiated differently. Like, I know people do say, and in theory, a foul should be a foul. But I kind of am okay with them letting a little bit of contact go. The biggest thing for me, though, is the technical rules. You got to call a travel. You got to call goaltending. Shout out to Portland. You got to call those types of things, backcourt violations, whatever, in the final minute. I'm less about I think I am generally about letting contact go. But anyway, I think it's an interesting conversation. Mike, do you want to hit us with a thing you noticed?
Yeah, so I'm going to bring it out east because I don't think we're going to do too much east stuff today, and that's totally fine. But yeah, I'm going to say the Detroit Pistons, give them some love. They're playing really well. They won six in a row. Not the most impressive teams on that winning streak resume, but I mean, anytime you can string together some wins, it's, people are going to start noticing you. Tobias Harris has been low-key playing very, very good basketball, averaging almost 20 a game. And then you got Andre Drummond averaging a healthy double-double right now too. So I like that. I haven't seen as much Pistons as I guess I'm going to start watching. But everything I've seen, I thought that Avery Bradley and Reggie Jackson wouldn't necessarily play all that well together. But it seems like they're coexisting and moving the ball really well. So I'm giving some props to the Pistons.
Well, I was just going to say, we talked a little bit about Andre Drummond. And, you know, he was a guy who was hard to get him on the court when he wasn't making free throws, but ever since he has,
yeah, no, he looks good.
We're seeing an entirely different, I mean, an entirely different person. Then you mentioned Tobias Harris, and I think the biggest, the one number that jumps out to me about Tobias Harris is just his 3-point percentage. I mean, the guy's shooting, he's got to be close to 45 or 50% right now. And it just seems like he's playing with so much confidence. And when he's on the floor, I don't know what it is this season. They're just a completely different team. I love the Avery Bradley pickup too. And I'm on record saying I think the Celtics lost a lot in between Jay Crowder and Avery Bradley, even though we haven't seen Jay Crowder be all that good for Cleveland just yet.
Yeah, you know, I think you have Tobias Harris playing great, playing probably the best basketball of his career right now, obviously. But then you also have Reggie Jackson, you know, back healthy again this year. I mean, he was injured the start of the year last year, missed a lot of time, and was really never himself when he came back. And I think that probably made a lot of people forget that Reggie Jackson is like actually a good basketball player. You know, I mean, he
gets a lot of hate.
He does get a lot of hate, and he probably deserves a good portion of it. Kind of brings it upon himself a little bit, but no, he just kind of, if you watch him play, like his burst is back. Like it just wasn't there last year. And he looks back this year. And I think, you know, just that pick and roll with he and Drummond is working again this year. And when you have that working, you surround it with guys, you know, Harris, Bradley, whoever, that are making some jump shots. I mean, that makes a huge difference.
Yeah, and I don't think Detroit has been, like, too great defensively yet or too great in any one area. I think that's the coolest part of this is, I don't know, I think we all kind of expected a little bit of regression with Orlando, and I think we expect some with Detroit. But, I mean, Detroit can actually be a playoff team and be, like, a pretty good team. Especially, I mean, they're probably not going to jump the Celtics even without Gordon Hayward. But what do we think Detroit's ceiling could be?
I think, like, a 5 maybe is, like, the very best. I still think they'll probably, you know, finish with the classic Detroit 7 seed in the East or something. They have a really telling stretch coming up. They're at Milwaukee, at Indiana, at Minnesota, all back-to-back road games. Then home against Cleveland, at OKC, at Boston. And then it stops getting difficult at all when they host the Suns. so it's going to be a really really interesting stretch for them there. I mean, because they could very well lose like 5 of those games.
Yeah, you know, I look at it. When you think about the other teams in the East, I mean, I think they're like absolute ceiling. Like best case is probably a 3 seed. I think like a realistic ceiling is probably in the 4 or 5 range. And again, I think one of the biggest things you talked about regression, you know, what we expect and what we don't. I think one of the more positive things with them is that their differential is like 4th best in the league right now. It's usually a pretty good indication of, you know, of being able to maintain your level of play.
Yeah, and I just looked up some of the numbers, but I mean, middle of the league offense, a little bit lower middle of the league rebounding, slightly above average defense. I think that it does kind of like, I don't know. It's kind of weird to me that their differential is as good as you just said. But again, for whatever reason, the pieces are starting to work there. I guess Stan Van Gundy gets some credit for that. And I think Stanley Johnson's been out a couple games too. So maybe adding some reinforcements there. Mike has his microphone on mute, and just watching him either cough or sneeze or whatever that was.
It was kind of a combination. It wasn't very pleasant.
That was just beautiful to watch. Okay.
I remember to mute the mic though.
Yeah. Thing I noticed, by the way, shout out to Mike for learning how to mute his mic.
That's right. I'm getting good.
The thing I noticed, Mike, do you know where Shavlik Randolph is currently playing?
Shavlik Randolph, no.
You know what country? Give me a guess.
I don't know, like Yemen.
Yemen. Okay.
Do they have basketball?
I think all Yemen has is war zones, if I'm not mistaken.
No basketball?
Yeah, I don't know much about Yemen. But no. I'm watching like a fight between Stephon Marbury and Jimmer Fredette in China. And I see a guy pulling.
Who's winning?
At neither one of them, because they're both playing basketball in China right now and getting into fights with each other. And I'm seeing this guy start to pull one of them back, and I'm like, oh my God, that's former Celtic, former Suns legend, Shavlik Randolph. So I thought that was very amusing and a good segue into what else happened in China this week. Oh, yeah, one of the Ball brothers might get, you know, imprisoned or something. He's on house arrest in a 5-star hotel or something. I thought that might be fun to talk about just briefly. Mike, impressions of LiAngelo Ball's trip to the Louis Vuitton story in China.
It's so stupid. I mean, allegedly. I know, like, allegedly stupid. I never understand these guys that have all this money yet still. I mean, maybe he doesn't himself have this money yet, but with Ball and the family, they're probably all just, you know, rolling in dough. But I just don't get it. You have so much money. Buy it. Buy the sunglasses, you know? Why have this need to steal, especially when you're not in America? I mean, if you're going to steal, you probably should do it in America because, like, you're stealing from, like, our own country. It's not as rude, probably. But if you, like just don't go to China and steal. It's a different kind of, you know, part of the world. It's more of a big deal. It's always bad, but it's a kind of a huge deal in China. And so I'm just, like, imagining, like, in 24 when Jack Bauer goes back to China, like, I'm just, like, hoping that he doesn't get, like, 24'd.
I just think you kind of hit on it, but I mean, you've got to be smart. If you're going to a foreign country, you don't break any laws because they can – I mean, the normal punishment, it's not going to end up this way. I think the reporting has seemed to suggest he's just going to be on house arrest for a few weeks in a, like I said, a very nice hotel. But the normal crime for this or whatever would be 3 to 10 years in prison.
With like a 99% conviction rate.
Yeah, 99%. Like – all these countries have very different rules, and I just think the arrogance of a kid to actually shoplift in like another country like that, when you have a brother who's in the NBA, you have a dad who is a marketing genius, whether or not people like him. I actually thought that said a lot about. I don't want to be like the get off my lawn, like, oh, the character of children nowadays. I think that says like an incredible amount of the arrogance of someone that they would think that any of that is acceptable.
Yeah, arrogance and stupidity. I mean, like, that's like going to North Korea and just yelling in the middle of the street, like, boo, Kim Jong-un, boo. Like, it's like you can't do that stuff.
Slightly different, but I get your point.
Yeah, I mean, you guys basically hit on everything. Just completely idiotic. And I mean, The thing is, you know, I could be wrong. I think Fran Fraschilla said this on the KU broadcast, the KU basketball game the other day. You know, you don't pay full price for anything in China. Like, everything is already cheap over there. Like, why are you shoplifting? Like, you definitely – he doesn't have the money, but, like, you don't think he could get it? Like, I just don't – I don't understand what possibly could have been going through his head, the other two players' heads. I don't even know either of their names, which is kind of funny, but – Well, it's incredibly stupid.
That's all part of the LeVar master plan, right? Is that we know LiAngelo's name, and I know LaMelo, who I forget which one sucks and which one's like actually okay.
LaMelo's the one that's okay. LiAngelo sucks.
Lonzo sucks.
That's the thing is LiAngelo, I think, is probably the worst out of the three, like the worst player out of the three kids that got in trouble.
LaMelo scored – is he the guy who scored like a billion points?
Yeah.
I don't know, but he's so grounded.
Well, the other thing about LiAngelo is if he gets banned from China – we were talking about this before you got on, Mike. That's a country. He may not – like he may need to play in China at some point, either as part of whatever team he's with, or he may not be good enough to make the NBA, and he may have to go like look for overseas leagues, and the Chinese basketball league is a pretty big league.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. I didn't even think about that. He's really hurting his future.
All right. We have kind of danced around this long enough. This is going to be a predominantly Oklahoma City Thunder podcast. Do we have any other quick things to get to before we jump right in and start burning the Thunder down?
Let it burn.
All right. Thunder, and this is the hallmark of every team that things are going wrong for. See the Cleveland Cavaliers. Yeah, we just talk about teams that have players meetings is actually what's going to end up happening here. But after starting 4-7, losing a game at Denver that they looked really good in early, they had one of these players meetings where they talked about, they didn't really say what, but it can be assumed, you know, expectations, what's going wrong, what they need to fix, their frustrations. They came back with a win over a super injured Clippers squad and a pretty terrible Mavericks team too. But really, this team hasn't clicked the way we thought it would from the start, at least that I did. Maybe that was, you know, a miscalculation on my part. Evan, you're the Thunder guy. Talk to us about the Thunder. What hasn't worked so far that you maybe thought would have been working by now?
Well, you know, they're a little bit worse off right now than I maybe thought. I actually was one that kind of thought they would take some time and they would probably be hovering around 500 by month's end here. But, you know, again, I think the main thing is just you take three guys who have been playing, you know, one way their entire careers, which is, you know, predominantly ISO ball. You know, anytime you have one-on-one coverage, you know, it's go score. You've got to exploit that. When you put those three guys together, it's just, you know, it's just going to take some time. And I think they, you know, you mentioned the good start in Denver. They did the exact same thing in Sacramento. They did the exact same thing even before that against Boston. I think that's partially because, you know, that's when they're like, that's when Billy Donovan's message is like actually like, you know, going out. They're like doing what he says to start these games, but then they revert back to what they know later on and it's come back to bite them a couple times.
I think, I forget who it was. I think it was Paul George, I'm almost certain, but kind of threw the coaching under the bus a little bit. At least that's what a quote that I read from the Oklahoman kind of made it sound like. He basically said, we're, you know, when we have our second wave, referring to the bench, and they have their second wave, they're adjusting, and then we're not adjusting to that. Schematically, does it seem like the Thunder are kind of behind things?
Well, you mean like second wave, like second unit? Or I'd actually didn't see the quote. So
the quote, and I'll try and look it up right now, but the gist of it was that basically after, you know, you start the game, the other team starts the game, the benches come in, and then the other team starts to adjust, that the Thunder aren't adjusting back with those teams, and that's when they're kind of losing.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's tough to know how much of that is coaching and how much of that is, you know, these players. Because like I said, I think the beginning of all these games, you're seeing what Billy Donovan is preaching to them. You're seeing it work. But then they just haven't been able to keep that up for full games, and they revert back to what they know. They revert back to ISO-heavy basketball. You know, one thing they have done the last couple of games, you know, obviously tonight, you know, you can kind of discount that because Carmelo wasn't playing. They've started playing Paul George a lot more with the second unit instead of Carmelo, which I think is a good thing because Carmelo with the second unit is pretty much like rec ball. It's just give Melo the ball and the other guys just stand there. Whereas, you know, Paul George, it's more of a flowing offense, which is nice to see.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's that huge of an issue. They're kind of a team that, to me, just is just very reliant on, you know, jumpers going in and when they go through these stretches. Because I saw that Sacramento game, and I was just waiting for them to start like being serious and or trying or something like that. Because
the first quarter, that may have been like the worst basketball I've seen.
Yeah, it was overall, even the Kings, it was like one of the worst games I've seen in a while. But yeah, it's just it looks like they kind of check out at times. I don't think it's anything that, you know, you need to be concerned about. I think there's something to be said about having guys like Melo, Russ, and Paul George maybe overlooking a team like Sacramento, who really is a bad team and probably will never, ever beat the Thunder again for a few years. But I really don't think it's too much of an issue. I kind of also agree that the ball kind of sticks a little bit, especially when it is Melo and the other guys. And then it's just, I don't know. Adams doesn't really look like he's gotten into too much of a rhythm yet. I think that they're still working on, because the chemistry between Adams and Russ has always been pretty solid. But if you can get more of those, you know, pick and rolls with Melo, it would be huge.
Well, two things jump out of that. One, I think Steven Adams has been a little bit nicked up on and off this year. So I think that's kind of one thing that's been hampering him. Obviously, he missed the game today. But I kind of disagree with that in this. Obviously, Melo is not known as a ball mover. Russell Westbrook, Paul George, and Melo all ranked in the top 10 in isolations last year. So I think that fit is kind of naturally a problem. But I think a more systemic problem is, and this was from an ESPN article by Ben Golliver, was that the Thunder are dead last in the NBA, or were dead last at the time of this. I think it was written a couple days ago, in just passes total. And while that stat in of itself doesn't really mean a lot, I think part of that falls on the players and the fit, but I think a huge amount of that falls on the coaching, because you can have stars who make a lot of passing. You can have stars on teams who take a lot of threes, like the Cavs, who pass the ball a lot more. That number to me was shocking.
Yeah, see, to me that's not shocking, because they've been like pretty much dead last or close to for like the last 6 years now. Like, just pretty much ever since Harden, Durant, and Westbrook came up and became stars, they've always been far down in passing. Hasn't mattered who the coach is or head coach, whatever.
That's kind of interesting, because I know their assists, I think assist-wise, I forget what they are this year, but I know they were I looked it up earlier. It's somewhere in the notes, but they were several spots higher in at least assists. They weren't getting as many assists when it was Harden, Westbrook, and Durant. But then after Harden left, it seemed like, I think they ranked maybe 19th in the league or something like that in assists last year, or with the Durant and Westbrook.
Yeah, I mean, again, but you know, that's a product of a lot of assists are just, you know, Durant coming off screens, coming off curls, you know, back doors. Like, there's so many one pass possessions for them. I mean, it's either you hit Durant off a screen, you've got Ibaka pick and pop, you've got Adams pick and roll. Like, they just have never been that type of team to have the heavy ball movement, and that's fine. What isn't fine is when the action breaks down and that play is not there, you've got to be able to adjust and move the ball throughout the possession and not just, you know, dribble, 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 and then, oh crap, there's 5 seconds left on the shot clock.
I will say, I think that's kind of how things like Paul George only attempted one shot in the fourth quarter against Denver.
Yeah,
the Thunder only had one assist in the fourth quarter against Denver. I thought, and they obviously lost that game in the fourth quarter. I think they went into I think the game was tied after three quarters. So that to me was a little bit alarming. Obviously, Paul George has had, we'll talk about Paul George a little bit more in a bit, because he's had two monstrous games the last two nights. But what are you seeing in crunch time? Is it a lot of dribbling? I know we saw in that Minnesota game a while back, Russ found Carmelo Anthony for a three-pointer, and it worked. But what's going on in crunch time? Because I think the stat was that there were 0-5 or 0-6 in what are games that would have qualified for clutch time minutes.
Yeah. I think now they're 1-6 now, because the Clippers game last night, I think, would qualify. But no, I think the biggest issue in crunch time, you mentioned a lot of dribbling, and that has definitely been a problem. But, you know, I also think this might sound kind of odd, but guys are trying too hard to defer to each other, if that makes sense. Like, no one's real, like, there's not a clear hierarchy. And I'm not one to believe that, you know, you have to have this alpha and then like this guy, like, it has to be in order. But like, I think Rachel Nichols like said this exact thing on The Jump the other day, and I completely agree with her. Like, you've got to know who you are as a team, and they just don't know who they are yet. And, you know, it just led to a lot of uncomfortable looking possessions in crunch time to me.
I think that's a really interesting kind of road to go down. I was actually listening to the Jalen and Jacoby podcast. I don't often listen, but I just happened to be to this one episode, and Jalen Rose brought up the point that, kind of like you said, the stats between Russell Westbrook, Paul George, and Carmelo Anthony, in terms of they're all averaging between 7.2 and 7.8 made shots per game, all attempting between 16.9 and 17.7, all averaging right around 20 points, all of this about the same player efficiency rating. He mentioned that there kind of does need to be a pecking order. In Miami, it was LeBron, Wade, Bosh. In Cleveland, it was LeBron, Kyrie, Love. In Golden State, you know, in terms of offense, it was Steph, Clay, Draymond. Obviously, you know, in those cases, though, it was the third guy, the Draymond, the Bosh, the Love, who found ways to do other things to be useful. I think the biggest problem with Oklahoma City is that their third guy is Melo, and Melo doesn't have any other ways to be useful, especially when he's playing the four.
Well, I think the biggest problem right now is, this is going to sound kind of funny when I say it, but I think Paul George and Russell Westbrook respect Carmelo Anthony like way too much. Like, they think he's a lot better than he is. And
Mike is nodding.
Absolutely.
it's just kind of funny because, like, you know, there'll be possessions late in the game where, you know, you see the Melo Russ pick and roll, and Russell will dump it down to Melo, and it's like, you know, maybe you want to keep that ball yourself. Maybe you want to go, you know, you go make a play. Like, I think they just have too much confidence in Melo. Like, people will probably be quick to blame Carmelo Anthony for, you know, being equal and all those things as those guys, because it probably shouldn't be that way. But, you know, mostly it's not his fault. It's not like he's looking to take over these games, you know, by any means. It's just like they're just kind of feeding him the ball. And Paul George is by far the most passive of the three. And he, you know, up until the last couple of games, he'd been the third wheel, like the clear third wheel offensively, which, you know, is a huge problem, because he is, you know, it's very easily, you know, Westbrook, Paul George, gap. You know, I mean, he's got to be the number two guy.
Yeah, like a 1A, 1B scenario. People can't see your hands because this is a podcast, but they were very close to each other.
Yeah, I tried to do a, you know, gap. I said gap out loud to maybe try and make it make sense. But
that was nice. That helps.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I think that's interesting, too, because in my estimation, Paul George is a really awesome offensive weapon. And you mentioned playing him a little bit more with the bench unit. I actually noted the Thunder's, prior to these last two games, the Thunder's most common lineup outside of the starting lineup, obviously, was Melo with no one else on the floor. So no bench, you know, like no one else on the floor from the stars. Basically Melo playing with the bench unit. And I thought that was kind of interesting, just because that was kind of the idea that I was thinking about coming into the season. But as you kind of mentioned, I don't think it's working. I had kind of a radical idea. I just wanted to kind of ask you guys about, and Mike, we can start with you. Maybe I'm wrong here. Carmelo Anthony, it just doesn't seem like he fits. And I was all for the signing. So, no, I'm not like saying like, oh, blah, blah, blah. I was saying this all along. But you see a game like tonight. Billy Donovan calls it their best defensive game of the season, their best passing game of the season after the game in the interviews. Melo didn't play. Obviously, Steven Adams didn't play, and the Mavericks suck. But I think tonight was a clear example of how Russell Westbrook and Paul George can play off each other, and why I wanted Melo with the bench unit. For some reason, though, it just isn't working. So do you think the Melo signing maybe could have been a mistake even?
I mean, it's a little too early for me to think that it's a mistake. Obviously, you know, it's got some question marks around it right now. Because I thought it was actually a pretty good idea, too, and for pretty much the same reason as you. I thought it would be perfect to play him with the bench. It's kind of like how I think we all agree that we would like to see Clay play with the second unit a little bit more. I'm kind of like that he does. But it's just Melo's the kind of guy where he is streaky, you know. There's going to be some games where maybe he'll go out for like 40 and everyone's going to be like, this was the best signing in the world. Oh, my God. But, yeah, they also just haven't figured out their rotations. These are like three very ball-dominant guys that – are so used to having it their way to being there. It's the new three alphas, you know, after Jimmy, Rondo, and it was Wade. They're almost as, you know, almost as good as those three alphas. But yeah, right. No, but it'll work. Donovan's a good coach. He'll figure it out. I think it's an extraordinarily difficult task with, like, especially those three guys and their personalities and their style of play. But I don't think it's fair to say that it's a mistake at this point. But it's definitely not as easy as maybe some people thought it would be.
Yeah, you know, I pretty much agree with everything Mike said. Again, it's too early to say it's a mistake. And I think, you know, tonight you mentioned that this kind of shows how well Paul George and Russ can play off of each other. And, you know, the thing is, and I think this is really the biggest thing we haven't talked about, is that Russell, for the most part, just hasn't looked comfortable at all this season. And I think it's because he's bending over backwards to try and, you know, try and make sure they get what they want. And, you know, Melo's even said a couple times in post-game interviews, like, you know, Russ, like, we came here for you. You know, you go be you. And I think Russ kind of went out and did that tonight. And I think going forward, as long as they, you know, like I said, kind of get a clear hierarchy and, you know, Russ and Paul George are 1A, 1B, then I think the fit is fine. It's not the cleanest fit by any means, but again, when you think about what they gave up Cantor and they gave up McDermott, like, you know, two guys that couldn't even play against the Rockets last year in the playoffs. I mean, it's obviously a plus move.
But, well, and I agree with that generally. I just think the two things that are a problem, one I did write down, is Westbrook trying too hard to fit in, because I agree with you in that front. But one, I think the respect that you kind of mentioned that people around the league even give to Melo. I mean, Melo was asked about coming off the bench, and he laughed this idea off like he isn't currently like the second best small forward on the roster. I mean, he's a guy who has had problems playing power forward. He's a guy who has gotten destroyed defensively in clutch time situations because teams are just bringing Steven Adams away from the hoop And then there's literally no one to protect because Carmelo Anthony's your power forward. And he's been the captain of a horrible team for years. And he gets asked about coming off the bench, and his reaction is, hey, yo, they said I got to come off the bench.
Yeah, yeah, you're missing the best part of that story. Paul George was, like, walking behind the media as they asked that, and he yells, you know, hey, P, they said I got to come off the bench.
It's a big joke to him, but I think that represents part of the problem. And what you said is that people in the NBA, and this is why, by the way, players should never vote, be allowed to vote on awards, think Carmelo Anthony is – I mean, they think it's like the Kobe thing. When
ESPN, you ask most guys, like, toughest guy to guard, like, they say Melo. Like, a lot of guys say Melo.
They just don't, like, and maybe it is tough for them, but you look at the percentages, the stats, how his team performs, and across the board, they just fail. The second thing is, and this was on the Woj pod that I thought was incredibly interesting. It was with Bobby Marks and Royce Young. Those were the two people on it. He said that the Thunder are, despite saying that this is a long-term play, he says entirely will view this as a one-year move. This will be a one-year move, especially because if Melo opts into his contract, I think he could make like $28 million next year. There's no chance they're going to re-sign Paul George without restructuring everything, even if Paul George said, I want to come back because of what they're paying Westbrook, because Adams is going to make $100 million, and because Anthony's going to be making $28 million. So that's where I'm kind of coming at this when I say, like, I could see this in a realm being a mistake in that, let's say this team gets the sixth seed this year, because they're going to make the playoffs. Let's not have any disillusions here. They're going to be a playoff team for sure. And then Melo takes his option, and they can't afford to keep Paul George, or they just have to gut their roster. In that regard, I could see the Melo thing being a mistake.
Yeah, see, I think, you know, obviously Woj and those guys are a lot more plugged in than we are by any means, but I think they're probably not making that move unless Clay Bennett is, like, ready to fork over the big bucks. And, you know, it's always risky, you know, obviously counting on the owner to pay that. But, you know, I think this was always their plan. That's why they didn't want to pay the repeater tax with James Harden, was because, like, their plan was to pay right now. Like, this was supposed to be Westbrook and Durant's prime. Like, you know, their plan was to pay now, but so I don't think they would shoot. They would let Paul George walk, but I mean, who knows? Also, I'm not sure Melo opts into that deal. I think he's probably looking for years over
money.
1 year, $28 million.
Yeah, I was thinking about that because there's no way. I mean, what does Carmelo get on his next contract? God, some team like the Bulls is probably going to offer him 20.
I was going to say, I could see Chicago, you know, like kind of Carlos Boozering or Dwayne Wading.
Oh, God. I can't see him, though. I mean, what's he going to make, like $20 million a year tops?
Probably, but again, if you can get a, you know, three-year, $55 million deal, or take a one-year, you know, one-year opt-in for $28 million and risk falling off even more, you know, you take the three-year deal every time.
I do think it'd be kind of interesting if Melo would be willing to opt out and re-sign at a cheaper price.
Like, I mean, we can't count that out because he chose to go there. So, like, it's not like that's a place he doesn't want to be.
I like now. If you went to Melo and said, hey, 1 year, 28 or 3 years, $60 million. I mean, that would save the Thunder $8 million of luxury of whatever that would turn into with a luxury tax and repeat offender tax.
Again, isn't it times three? Isn't it like $24 million or something? I don't know. I could be speaking way out of term.
It's a lot of money. I mean, do you remember at some point it was
according to the charts, it's a lot.
There was a point where, like, if the Brooklyn Nets brought in LeBron James, the luxury tax would have been like $2 billion with a B.
That's worth it. Man.
Yeah, luxury tax is no joke.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, Bobby Marks, I thought this was just hilarious on the Woj pod.
I love his insights on the luxury tax, by the way. It's funny every time.
Oh, it's so funny. He said that he thinks Cleveland is vulnerable and that team should go all in against him. And I was like, dude, that was your exact strategy when you traded three first-round picks to get Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett from the freaking Celtics. Like, Bobby Marks should not be advising.
Do we know if that was a bad trade, though?
That's a great point, Mike.
No, I mean, they're, you know, KG, Paul Pierce, wow. No, that's like the worst trade of all time. Maybe the Suns with Thomas.
Come on, man. I was fine. We're still fine. Overall, I did want to one other thing about the Thunder that I have noticed that we can get to, and then we'll move on to our last topic of the day. Obviously, they have their problems defensively passing that they may or may not figure out. But one thing that's actually concerned me is Patrick Patterson's start to the year. Look, just looking at some of the numbers, he's played about 90% of his minutes this year at the five compared to, and he was kind of this like plus minus god in Toronto. He was playing 90% of his minutes at the four. Obviously, the Thunder don't have another center behind Enes Kanter. They have Dakari Johnson, but and he played well against DeAndre Jordan, so I'm not throwing him under the bus.
Yeah, Dakari looked good.
But they don't have another, obviously, like a full-time starting center guy. Any chance the Thunder should maybe try and change a rotation to maybe early in the game? I wrote down this lineup that maybe at the five minutes into the game, you would go to Russell Westbrook, Abrines, Patterson, George at the three, Adams at the five, and then you come back out with Roberson and Melo together on the bench.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I'm nodding my head so fast, I'm getting dizzy over here. Like, first of all, I think you've got to play Abrines with the starters, like, as much as possible because, you know, he is just such a threat, such a spot-up threat, and obviously Roberson is an absolute zero in that regard. So I think playing him with the starters a lot more helps. And yeah, I think Patterson getting him at the four a little bit more, where because he really struggles, you know, guarding bigger guys. That could be taking a toll on him. He may not be completely healthy because he had the knee surgery. Mm-hmm. He missed, like, all of training camp. And with the season starting even earlier this year, I think that probably didn't help his cause. And also, he was always a guy in Toronto anyway who was, you know, streaky, you know, much to the chagrin of Raptors fans. He would, like, go a month shooting, like, 15%, and then, like, you know, the next month be, like, 45% from three. So, you know, I'm expecting a bounce back from him at some point, a get-hot streak at some point here.
Yeah, I just like the idea of, like I said, moving guys to their more natural positions. The biggest problem is it's kind of hard to do, again, with Melo, because you can't really give Melo too many minutes at the three because, I mean, Paul George, Roberson, and Abrines, Grant has been playing really well. He's been playing three and four, I guess.
Scott, I mean, I'm going to get you calling him Roberson by the time we're all done here.
Roberson? What did I call him?
Roberson.
God damn it.
I remember. He gets a lot of steals. Robber. He's like a robber.
Roberson. Yeah. Roberson. Whatever it is. I don't know. I was impressed by Grant today, too. I kind of toyed with the idea of maybe moving, you know, making that first substitution Grant instead of Patterson. But I think if you can have the shooting of George, not Roberson. Man, you got me on.
No, you're right, Roberson.
But George, Roberson, and Patterson all together at the same time, George, Abrines, and Patterson. That shooting lineup with Russell Westbrook would be ridiculous.
You pick and roll Russ and Steven Adams to death, and you've got three spot up guys. You can run Paul George off some screens from Adams. Like, you know, offensively, that lineup is great.
Mike, if you had to, obviously, you said you're not concerned.
No.
Could where the Thunder finish the year? Give me a final record. I think they're at either 500 or maybe a game under 500.
They're 6-7 right now.
Game under 500, and that's after.
I still think they could be as good as like 20 games above. Man, like once they figure it out, like figure out their rotations, it's still going to be a really impressive run for them. I think they're going to comfortably finish at the three.
So 51-31.
Wait, no, four.
51-31. If they're 6-7 now, what would that be? 44 and I don't know. That's too much math. Evan,
finish
the final record in the seed.
Yeah, I'm with Mike. I think originally I thought they were going to be something like 52-54 wins, and I don't really feel a whole lot differently. Like I said, because I kind of expected the struggles early on. Not to this degree, but you know I think they're going to start rallying off some wins. And what's great is, you know, outside of the Warriors and the Rockets, like nobody else in the Western Conference is really, you know, running away and hiding. Like that three seed is still very up for grabs for them.
Yeah, for sure. I think Golden State and Houston are the two teams that obviously look great. And San Antonio has got some interesting things going on. San Antonio is like Stranger Things. I forgot
unmute the mic.
How's ho, Scott?
Thanks. It's going to sound a lot better when I cut that together to remove all the dead space. It's just,
you know, the thing I noticed this week was going to be if we didn't have all these elbows and flagrants and whatnot, it was going to be my it was going to be my conspiracy theory that the Spurs signed Rudy Gay because they knew Kawhi Leonard was out for a long time. Because I'm starting to get a little worried about our friend Kawhi Leonard.
Yeah, I need to change my MVP pick. I'm officially concerned.
To Mario Hezonja?
No, I was going to say Lauri Markkanen, but Hezonja works too.
Gabe Dirk.
Yep, that's right.
I forget what my stupid comparison was going to be. I think it was going to be like you always know what you're getting, and then sometimes like a kid gets kidnapped, and that's kind of like
I think I saw that in a fortune cookie.
Yeah, something like that. I don't know. It was going to be dumb. All right. Any parting thoughts on the Thunder before we move on? Evan, we'll start with you.
Yeah, just real quick, I did want to mention, you've talked a lot about their defense. You know, defensively, they've actually been like really good this year outside of clutch time. So that's what's been a little bit weird about about the whole string. You know, obviously, like their defensive rating is absurd, won't last in crunch time. But you know, their defensive rating is like 101 right now, second best in the league. I think their turnover percentage is like 17. Paul George is leading the league in steals. Like, you know, defensively they've been fine, except just not down the stretch.
No. That's a good distinction to point out. The Ben Golliver article that I was referencing mentioned exactly what you said. In crunch time, they're dead last in the league, I believe, in defensive rating. Overall, they've been a better defensive team than they've been an offensive team. I mean, they're a middle of the pack to lower middle of the pack shooting the ball even. So, no, I'm with you there. Mike, a final word on the Thunder.
Yeah, free Abrines. I love watching Abrines.
Such a Mike Makey player. All right. Final topic of the day. This is kind of something we talked about a while back, but now we actually have some closure. So Phoenix actually traded Eric Bledsoe finally to the Bucks, and there are a lot of moving parts here because Phoenix was a team that was playing better after its coach got fired and it sent Eric Bledsoe home. And on the other side, Milwaukee is a team that still hasn't moved into that contender range. Milwaukee to me is like the Denver of the East in that they should be in win now mode kind of, but also I'm not 100% sure that they actually like have a path to becoming the best team in the NBA short of their, you know, freak star player just absolutely becoming one of the best five players in the NBA.
They're freak. So, nice.
I was going to say to me, they're a little bit different than Denver. You know, just like you said, like, you know, I love Jokic, but to me, Jokic is not even close to the same plane, same level as Giannis. So again, if Giannis becomes what he has potential to be, which God knows what that actually is, it's something ridiculous. If he becomes what we all think he could be, then yeah, like they have a path in my mind.
All right, so let's start with the trade. We'll go down each side, what each side got. So obviously Phoenix loses Eric Bledsoe. They get back Greg Monroe, I believe a second round pick and a first round pick with some interesting protections. First with Greg Monroe, just for the matching contract. Greg Monroe was actually playing pretty well. He was playing limited minutes, but actually being pretty effective in them. He was buying in defensively and like starting to fit the system, and they're actually going to miss his presence a little bit off the bench. So I think the Suns are going to try and flip him maybe with other assets in the trade, but either way, he's an expiring contract. I said this on Twitter and I maintain this. He was the least important part of the trade other than the second round pick that got moved.
Yeah, you know, completely agree. You said that he had been playing pretty well lately. I actually work with a Milwaukee Bucks fan, as strange as that might sound, who he was sad to see Monroe go. Like, you know, Monroe, like you said, has been pretty good for them this year.
The Suns pick, so this is how the first round pick works. It'll be this year if it's 11 through 16. So that would be the Bucks sneaking into the playoffs or having one of the worst records of a playoff team, or obviously missing the playoffs and not, you know, ending up with a top three pick. That's okay with me because I think the Bucks are going to be picking about 20 this year. So that's fine that it won't cash this season. Next year it's protected 4 through 16. So again, pretty much exactly the same. Excuse me, 11 to 16 this year. 4 to 16 next year. So that's kind of what I said. That again, if it's a good pick, the Suns will get it. If not, it'll go again to the next year. In 2020, it is top 7 protected. The Suns are pretty much guaranteed to get it in 2020 because I don't see any way the Bucks are picking in the top 7. And then in 2021, it's unprotected. I'm actually really happy the Suns got an unprotected at the end of it because a lot of trades, a lot of times, the protected picks convey into multiple second rounders. And I think that was something the Suns couldn't afford to do. Initial thoughts on the protections for either one of you guys?
Yeah, that's a really, really, really protected pick. That's like super, you know, interesting there. Because at one point you want to, you know, speed up this rebuilding process, but then you kind of also want that unprotected one in 2021. So, I mean, right? Like you'd rather obviously have that than the Bucks kind of underachieve this year then.
Or yeah, then like the 23rd pick in the draft this year. And it's like, oh, that's great. And, yeah, and the Suns have two Miami picks coming. One's unprotected, one's top seven protected. So they have a ton of picks. They're
to get an unprotected first round pick for someone that didn't want to be there and you had almost no leverage with, and not to mention Greg Monroe, who is a very good player. I think the Suns did well for what they could have done.
Yeah, I think that's my biggest takeaway here, is that just the situation the Suns were in, they did probably as, you know, they didn't do great, but they did like as well as you could probably expect in this situation, I think.
My reaction to it was like, oh, okay. Like, it wasn't bad. It wasn't great. It was just like, yeah, okay. Like,
all right.
Yeah, I'm living my Tuesday. It's fine. I'm going to go to the football press conference today, talk to David Beatty a little bit. It's going to be a Tuesday.
They just kind of got to a point where they needed to get Bledsoe out of there.
I will say this. I think there's huge upside on the protections if, and this is a very specific if, Giannis is up for a new contract. He'll be unrestricted after 2021. There's been a lot of talk about, will he request out of Milwaukee? He says he wants to stay there. He likes being in a small market.
He wouldn't be who he was if he wasn't in a small market.
So does every small market star ever.
Tread lightly, Milwaukee fans.
Yeah. But if Giannis requests out, or the Eric Bledsoe thing is interesting in of itself, because Milwaukee really wants to avoid repeater tax, and Eric Bledsoe is going to put them in the luxury tax for the next 2 years, which is an area in a small market they don't want to be. If Giannis gets unhappy, maybe they don't retain Eric Bledsoe and Giannis asks out, that 2021 pick or even the 2020 pick could end up being like a really nice pick if Giannis leaves. And I think that might have been, if I'm trying to go inside Ryan McDonough's head, which I do not want to be there at all, I think that's what he might have been thinking is, hey, on the tail end of this, what if Giannis asks his way out, and then in 2020, it's the 10th pick in the draft?
Yeah, what if Eric Bledsoe's at another barbershop and decides he doesn't want to be there in a couple of years?
People are giving the Suns a hard time for the haul, kind of like Mike did, because you mentioned like how little they got for Thomas, Dragic, and Bledsoe. I just want to say one thing real quick, just so I can like have my peace with this, and then we can move on to the Milwaukee side. If you think about what the Suns acquired their 3 point guards for, they signed Dragic in free agency. They got Bledsoe for Jared Dudley in a second round pick, and got Isaiah Thomas for Alex Oriaki. They traded the three of them for 4 first round picks.
Dudley's pretty good. Dudley's a Suns legend.
They got Dudley back anyway, so it doesn't matter, but they traded the three of them for basically 4 first-round picks and other pieces. But I'm not saying it's great. It obviously blew up, and Ryan McDonough didn't consider personalities when he brought them all in at all. But Ryan McDonough turned a second-round pick and 2 players, Jared Dudley, who's back on the team, and Alex Oriaki, who's never going to play, basically into 4 first-round picks. So I know he takes a lot of crap because he's horrible at managing like the personality side of it. I don't know. The Suns basically reset themselves to where they are, just with a lot more assets.
Yeah, you know, to me, it's a little bit comparable to the whole James Harden Oklahoma City trade, which I can't believe I'm like voluntarily bringing that up. But you know, like, you know what they got back when you actually look back on it, like, you know, Jeremy Lamb bust, obviously, you know, Kevin Martin not there anymore, but you know, they have Steven Adams, a for sure top 10. Maybe potentially at some point top 5 center in the NBA. But
he
again,
might be top 5 now.
He could possibly be top 5 now. But, you know, again, you know, I just compare it to the Suns where, like, the return, you know, it's still fine. Like, there's still some good things there. But, like, you know, you obviously didn't maximize those assets. The Thunder obviously didn't maximize, you know, their asset in James Harden.
I agree with that entirely. I just think it's so annoying to see on Twitter people be like, wow, look at all 3 of these guys are gone. It's like, well, they also brought them in for nothing. And if Ryan McDonough can bring in those 3 players for basically nothing, who's to say with what do the Suns have? The Suns have two Miami picks, a Milwaukee pick, and all their own picks. So potentially the next 4 years, they have seven first-round picks. And I think, I don't know, the one Miami one's unprotected, and there's all the other stuff. That's a, you can work with that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you're preaching to the choir as far as like being annoyed with people on Twitter acting like you got nothing back. Like, you know, people act like the Thunder got absolutely nothing back for James Harden, which, again, isn't true. You just didn't get back what you could have got.
Yeah, it's like these two people on Twitter that were really attacking the Bulls for the Jimmy Butler trade.
That was just a bad trade.
Yeah, it wasn't great.
All right, as for Milwaukee, we'll close it out here. I thought this move was super interesting. Mike, we'll start with you. Bledsoe, athletic point guard, has the potential to be a good defender, improved shooter, good rebounder, good passer. What do you like this move for Milwaukee, or yeah. Do you hate this move?
No, I really like it. I think that Bledsoe is the type of player that fits in with Milwaukee. I mean, hopefully he has kind of a volatile personality, so hopefully, you know, he enjoys all the intangibles and off-the-court things too. But just play style, I like it. Like, because like you said, I think Bledsoe is a good defender. Milwaukee's kind of a defensive, I guess they're getting a little bit faster, but they don't mind playing in the half court. So I think Bledsoe's going to be a nice compliment. And then you got, Dele coming in off the bench, who's actually been having a pretty decent year. So I like it. I think it's a good move. They didn't give up all that much. Monroe is a bit of a loss, but it looks like they're trying to transition to more athletic, like maybe younger and quicker teams. So I like it. I think it was good.
Yeah, I think what they're counting on a couple things here at this trade. Number one, they're counting on, you know, Thon Maker. They're counting on him to continue to improve. They're counting on John Henson to be able to kind of fill in a little bit more for Monroe. They're also in my mind, I think they're counting on they're hoping. I think they're probably hoping to get rid of Dele. Would be my guess. I mean, that you talk about the repeater tax, like that's how you escape it right there, is you ship that terrible contract out of town.
Yeah, don't they have Toledovich too?
Yeah, they've got to find a way. If they can get rid of Dele and Toledovich.
I think they can waive Toledovich maybe after this year. The other thing, they're counting on Jabari Parker actually being healthy.
Yeah.
That's one part of this equation. If Jabari Parker comes back, they won't miss Greg Monroe at all. But if Jabari Parker continues to be Jabari Parker and miss games every year with injuries, they've got a void there because he's up for a new contract this year, I believe.
This summer, yeah. I mean, they weren't even in the same stratosphere when they were negotiating before the season, because Jabari was looking to get paid like what he could potentially be, and the Bucks probably would have done that if he didn't have like three injuries already.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other part of – that's why this repeater tax thing comes up, is that if some team makes a huge offer to Jabari in restricted free agency and the Bucks don't get it handled before then, like, I'll give you the example of the Suns. The Suns are going to be $2.5 billion under the cap, basically, when this year hits, especially losing Greg Monroe's salary. Why don't the Suns just walk over to Milwaukee, say, hey, Jabari Parker, why don't you sign a four-year, $80 million offer sheet?
Turn to the Brooklyn Nets of the West.
Yeah, why not? And then if the Bucks won a match, fine. God bless you. You just spent $20 on a guy who might not play. And if the Bucks don't match, the Suns get Jabari Parker.
Yeah, absolutely. Just real quick, did you watch their game the other night, or at least like see who they started with? How did they start Brogdon and Bledsoe?
I think Brogdon's returned to the bench in Milwaukee. I only watched a little bit, but what I did see was in crunch time, Bledsoe hit a huge jumper in the Spurs game, actually. And then Giannis, after the game, had a ton of compliments for him, basically saying, like, he makes it so easy to play with him.
I saw someone on Twitter say, you know, the alley-oop that Bledsoe had, had the Giannis, like, the one-handed dunk. It was so funny because someone was like, they haven't even practiced together yet. And it's like, guys, like, these are NBA players. Like, they can throw alley-oops to each other.
The only funnier thing is that Mike's Wi-Fi has crapped out, so he's no longer here. And we can't talk about Tony Snell, who's starting with Middleton and Bledsoe in the backcourt in Milwaukee now. Mike's favorite player, Tony Snell, three-point sharpshooter.
Yeah, I was going to say, three-point extraordinaire, Tony Snell. centerpiece of the marvelous Micah Carl Williams trade, Tony Snell.
People forget that Tony Snell, right after Mike said he was like a really horrible three-point shooter, because he was like, I think it was right after seasons, he was shooting 37 and 36%. Since then, 40%, and this year, 49% from three. So Tony Snell is determined to make Mike Mackey eat his words.
Yeah, you know, another guy that they just paid, you know, in the offseason. Again, it was a very reasonable contract, yeah. But you know, still, you know, when you're a small market and you have to make those decisions, kind of interesting they chose to pay him with the potential bills they have coming up.
Well, yeah, because I think he's making, like, wasn't it 10 mil a year? Or yeah. Did I get that wrong? But
I think you're right.
To tie it back to the Thunder, and we'll close it out here, I mean, the Thunder didn't pick up the fourth-year option for Josh, Lord, Huestis. I knew that was so wrong.
It's funny because a lot of, like, anytime they're ever on national TV and he, like, somehow plays, like, that's 100% when he gets called every time.
Yeah, well, but the other thing is, like, he's actually been playing, like, fairly decently for them, and I know the Thunder like him. They stuck him in the D League for a year, and he's been kind of coming up and, like, actually starting to perform. Do you think they get him to take a veteran minimum contract?
I don't know, man. Like, it's funny that you bring him up because, like, he is probably the most talked about 15th man, like, in the history of the NBA, because the way they've handled him is just so weird. Like, he agrees to be the first domestic draft and stash. Like, they draft him in the first round way above where he would have gone. And they're like, you know, hey, you're going to the D League. We're going to sign you to a rookie scale deal in a year or two. It's so funny. And he was playing a lot at the beginning of the year. And literally as soon as he didn't get that option, relegated back to the bench. Now, he's played again lately because of some injuries to the front court. But, you know, I think the only reason he really got much playing time was because, you know, Sam Presti probably said, you know, hey, we want to see this guy. We want to see if he's worth, you know, picking up his option, which, you know, they didn't give him a chance to play last year. In their season of discovery, as Sam Presti coined it, they failed to discover whether or not Josh Huestis could actually play last year. I don't know, man. You ask me to predict anything with what's going to happen with Josh Huestis, it's been like the weirdest handled situation. They're like kind of Jeremy Lamming him out of town.
Yeah, and I just thought it was crazy because I think they were only on the hook for like $2 million. But again, that speaks to if both these guys come back, they may be stripping their team entirely of anything that's not Steven Adams, Carmelo Anthony, Russell Westbrook, and Paul George.
Yeah, well, you know, Jeremy Grant was another guy who they could have picked up his option early. His deadline was earlier. I don't really understand. I don't know the rules of why Houston's deadline was like 2 weeks ago and Grant's was like before the season. But they could have picked up Jeremy Grant's fourth-year option for, like, you know, around $1 million because he was a second-round pick. I think he's on the Hinkie contract, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong. But they chose not to. And I mean, he's a guy that could very easily – you know, Jeremy Grant has a good year. Like, I could see a team giving him $7-8 million, which may seem a little bit low. But, you know, again, the salary cap is going to kind of be a problem for a lot of teams this summer.
Well, yeah, if you're not willing to pay him $1 million, you're certainly not going to be willing to pay him $8
million. Yeah, and it's kind of funny that both of those guys are the two guys that haven't got their options picked up because they're, like, very much the same player. Like, they do a lot. Like, Huestis is a little bit more polished, but, like, Jeremy Grant, you know, more of a high riser. But they do a lot of the same things. Like, they bring a lot of the same things to the team.
Only thing I can think of here, and this would be insane if this was actually the Thunder strategy, if they waited to re-sign Paul George, theoretically, and Melo waited, I don't know, or he opted out and then they were going to re-sign both of those guys and, like, go into bird rights. I don't know what the rights are there. But if they were going to handle it that way, they could theoretically make more signings and be freeing up more cap space to make a signing of some magnitude and say, we're going to save every $1 million now that we can, maybe offer a guy $12 million and then re-sign both those. The only reason that would be crazy is that would put you so far over the cap that there's no way. I forget the Thunder owner's name. I know he's like a low-key guy.
Clay Bennett,
yeah. There's no way Clay – I know he wanted to save money earlier on, and that was the whole point of the Harden thing and whatever, but there's no way – like, no owner would be willing to pay that tax because aren't they already paying, like – don't they have, like, a $20 million bill or something ridiculous this year?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I think they're, like, the third highest payroll. And, you know, it's funny, before all of the, you know, Paul George, Carmelo Anthony moves, the big story for them going into the offseason is, you know, what in the world are they going to do? Like, they've got this extension sitting on Russell Westbrook's, you know, table, but they have this 45-win team that probably isn't actually a 45-win team. Like, they're not paying the tax for that. Like, are they going to go try and shed salary cap? So it is interesting to follow going forward. They have a lot of very interesting decisions to make. I am confident that none of us can predict anything Sam Presti is going to do because he's probably been the most unpredictable general manager in the NBA since he's taken over. So, I mean, again, it's going to be a very interesting situation to follow. And, you know, they've got the right guy at the helm, I guess.
I just looked up. I think they're like $13 million over the tax and with comparable salary to Cleveland. So, again, that kind of goes into it. Would be pretty shocking if they were doing this to bring in a major free agent. But I could buy this as them doing this to re-sign these guys and then only add veteran minimums who aren't going to play and basically say, we think we have enough. But either way, super interesting.
Yeah, I mean, maybe Robertson's deal is tradable. I mean, he only signed three-year $30 million, so he only has two and 20 left on it. That's not like a super big contract.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what they do. All right, it's a good place to close it out for us. Thanks again for listening to Triple OT. You can follow any of us on Twitter, Evan at Evan R. Riggs, Mike at MJ_Makey. I'm at Jason Scott. Credit to Tricky Diesel, who produced the music on today's show. So for all of us, thanks again for listening, and we will see you next week.
Good one, guys.
Then f***ing Victor Oladipo got fouled on a three-pointer. The next possession.
And it was not.
We need this rigged.